This is the BBC third programme. In our series America Since the Bomb, we're now broadcasting Blacklisting on Trial. This is the story of a man's fight to clear his name in the American courts against an accusation that he was involved in a communist conspiracy. It's also the story of the damages awarded to him when he won his case. He tells the story himself. His name is John Henry Fork.
First off, I would like to say that when the jury awarded me $3.5 million judgment in my suit that you've just this moment heard mentioned, actually it had a very therapeutic effect on my bruised feelings. And if you ever get involved in one and get anything approaching that award, you can understand what I mean. But it distressed me too. It distressed me because the issues that were involved in the case were completely obscured by the $3.5 million judgment, which was a record-breaking judgment for hurt feelings here in America, and I presume anywhere else. It just, as one of my uncles said to me, he didn't know Lyndon Johnson's feelings could be hurt that bad. At any rate, I thought that a bit of my background and a bit of the background of this lawsuit would be appropriate before I relate actually what occurred. I was born, grew up in Austin, Texas, came to New York City shortly after World War II, and had the good fortune to become rather successful in network radio and television. And in the early 50s, my star was rising pretty rapidly as a radio humorist. And this, of course, was a very pleasant sensation. At the same time, during that period, there existed in the radio and television industry an organization called AWARE Incorporated. It consisted of a group of citizens who banded together and formed a corporation, the purpose of which was to combat the communist conspiracy in radio and television in the United States. Now, this presumes, you have to make a couple of presumptions here before you can accept AWARE's existence. Number one, that there did exist indeed a communist conspiracy in the radio and television industry. And number two, that AWARE was qualified and authorized to combat it. And as far as I was concerned, neither one of those situations existed. At any rate, the way AWARE went about combating this dread conspiracy in radio and television was to periodically publish a bulletin that listed the names of prominent radio and television personalities, and if I listed some of those names for you now, you would recognize them because they were nationally known and internationally known in many instances. At any rate, AWARE didn't stop at just listing their names and saying these persons were suspected and possibly guilty of subversion on one level or another, but they took these lists and sent them to all of the sponsors. You see, we have commercial radio and television in America. Sent them to the sponsors who sponsored the shows and consequently paid the performers. Sent them to the networks, the employers of the talent in America. And they also sent them to the advertising agencies who sometimes employed radio and television talent. And not being satisfied with just having sent these scurrilous bulletins listing the names of these persons, they went a step further. They got in touch with these employers and networks and agencies and the sponsors and threatened to expose them as collaborators with the communist conspiracy if they didn't fire these persons immediately. And a surprising thing had happened. This became, incidentally, kind of a routine process because, you see, when you're running a show like that, you have to have new bodies all the time. So the reasons for a person being listed grew ever more tenuous and further out and further out. It reached the point that one could almost have walked past a newsstand on which was sold the Daily Worker, and he could get himself listed if he glanced at the headlines or something. That's ridiculous, but it really reached almost that point. But the networks and the agencies and the sponsors cooperated in the sense that they didn't want to get involved in a controversy about their talent. Consequently, it was much easier to simply dismiss or fire any talent that was so listed. It was much easier to do that than get involved in a legal argument over whether the man was really subversive or not, because you see, once a network or an employer took the position of I'm firing you because AWARE says that you're subversive, well, quite obviously the man would say, might sue the network, see, and say, aren't you and AWARE, prove it now, or else pay me some large sums of money. So it was much easier for these people simply to be dismissed Without any explanation at all. They were never told that they were being dismissed for that. There was a huge reservoir of talent here, as there is in England, attempting to get a job. So there were always people that could replace them. And this, as I say, became a routine pattern in the early 50s, at the very time that I was making something of a large fortune every day, however weak, on radio and television, because I was never touched by this. I was not considered in any way important enough, perhaps, nor certainly subversive enough to be listed, and I'd never said anything tacky or unfortunate that could get me into difficulties, or so I thought. But I was uneasy, and as the blacklist, and this, by the way, these persons who were fired, these performers, be they singers, dancers, announcers, newscasters, actors, actresses, whatever they were, as they were fired, they entered what we called the blacklist, that kind of a limbo of unemployability. And they had no recourse to anyone because they hadn't been told why they were fired. They simply became unemployable. And as this list grew, the scandal grew, and the word went out amongst all performers, both in Hollywood and in New York, you best keep your mouth closed and your opinions to yourself, because if you attack this group called Aware, if you criticize them at cocktail parties or publicly, word might get back to them, and they will do exactly what Senator McCarthy always did. If anyone criticized him, he didn't say, well, I don't feel that criticism is justified, or I would like to debate the point with you and discover whether you or I are right. McCarthy would simply say, you're red. This man's a red. He's a communist, part of the conspiracy, see, and this effectively disarmed the opponent always. Very well. Then in the mid-50s, along about 55, I had become so uncomfortable, and this had become such a scandal that a great number of friends of mine were entering the blacklist. And incidentally, you could do one of three things when you found yourself blacklisted. You could either go to Aware and say, look, I have been bad. I have been a bit subversive. I didn't realize that I was being subversive when I signed that petition or attended that meeting back in 1944 or 45 or contributed to Russian war relief during World War II. I didn't realize that would be regarded as subversive someday, but I did. I'm ashamed of it. I'll never again sin. As a matter of fact, I'll take up the cudgel for Aware and always salute when they're near. And Aware would let you up that way. They would perhaps dismiss, and that usually was accompanied by some money, an exchange of money. Now, that was one way. Another way was to commit suicide, which a number of performers did through the harassment that after months and months of unemployment and frustration and humiliation, they simply shuffled off this mortal coil. Another way was to go to England, where they weren't as frightened at the communist conspiracy, and find work in a number of very prominent American performers went to England, where they weren't harassed for their political opinions or alleged political misdeeds in the past. Then another way, of course, was to quit the profession entirely and start selling shoes or real estate or work in a delicatessen. Some did that. At any rate, as I say, in the mid-50s, I had become so uncomfortable about this that one night at a cocktail party, I encountered several of my friends who felt, as I did, that this was quite an outrageous thing to be going on. And we fell to talking about our union. All performers in radio and television in the United States must belong to the American Federation for Television and Radio Artists. And we said, why doesn't the union do something about this? It's their business to protect the working interest of their members. And I found out to my surprise that at that time, the board of directors of the union were also members of the board of directors of Aware. Well, this shocked the daylights out of me. And consequently, if you got up at a union meeting and protested the practice of blacklisting, you could be stepping on the toes of the directors of the union, who were also directors of Aware, and find yourself blacklisted thereby. It was a pretty hideous state of affairs, as far as I was concerned. So I persuaded these friends to run in the union against this slate of officers who belonged to Aware. And bless goodness, the membership of the union was so outraged by blacklisting that they swept us into office in 1956, in January of 1956, an overwhelming majority. And here I was, I'd headed the slate, one of the top officers of the union all of a sudden. And we had declared that we were going to save the membership from blacklisting. We were going to re-inaugurate all kind of programs of seeing that they were properly protected and all. But within 2 weeks, Aware had published another bulletin naming us as the arch fiends and villains of all time, and me in particular, because I'd headed the slate as a real conspirator, claiming that Mr. Falk says that he's not a communist or a member of the communist conspiracy. But let's look at Mr. Falk's background. And then they hint very broadly that actually I hadn't come from Texas at all, but had been put ashore from a Russian submarine. really, it was a pretty shocking thing. They circulated this to all of my sponsors and began to put pressure on. And the members of my slate who had been victorious became agitated, very worried, and began to find excuses for not being members of the slate any longer. As a matter of fact, several of them went over and joined the other side to cleanse their souls and to make themselves pure. Now, I know this is rather incomprehensible to the British that a thing like this could happen. This was a result of the fear, the pall of fear that fell across the United States at that time, where a man was afraid to express an honest opinion, lest it be misinterpreted properly by aware as dissent, because they equated subversion with dissent. At any rate, they circulated this business on me, so then the network, understandably, began to get a little jittery about the way things were going. And most of my friends began to give me about a 10-foot leeway as I walked down the street or get up and leave the table at a restaurant that I would stroll up to. They'd think of another appointment very quickly. And I got very uncomfortable and got word that I was going to be released from my employment. But about this time, a couple of the sponsors of mine who were outraged by these letters that had been written by Aware, the Aware people urging my dismissal from the air, that I was a rather dangerous man to be coming into the homes of the public every afternoon, these sponsors brought me these letters. So I had, for the first time in my hands, tangible evidence of this conspiracy against me, of this libelous material being circulated. And I made a very important decision. I felt that the public in America, very much like the public in England, consists 99.9% of fine, decent, and respectable people who won't put up with injustice if they understand it to be injustice, and that if they ever got a look at the machinations of Aware Incorporated in a court of law, then they would take care of them themselves. So I decided to sue them. And a very good friend of mine, Mr. Edward R. Murrah at CBS, was applauding in the background and going about enthusiastically, clapping me on the shoulder and saying, "Have at 'em, John, I'll back you to the hilt." And he did. He stood behind me, but happened to be about the only man that did. At any rate, I got Louis Neiser. Now, perhaps you don't know who Louis Neiser is in England, but he is a ferocious lawyer that can make you weep as he tells of the terrible things that happened to his clients and the villainy of the other side. So I employed him to carry my colors in this court fight, and to Aware's great astonishment, they were sued. And Mr. Neiser sued them for a conspiracy to libel me, and he mentioned in the subhead of this lawsuit that they were engaged in a dreadful racket, patriotism for profit, that this was a way they made money off the lives and careers of people. Oh, it was a shocking suit. And it made me feel real good, but none of my friends feel good, because now they said, the fat's in the fire. Old John Falk's in trouble. He's gone and got himself publicly involved in a controversy, and they avoided me even more. And then the network fired me. And then I began to look for work in other places, and there was no work forthcoming. It was a very fascinating thing to see what fear did to our society. These people would shake my hand silently, you know, and wink at me and say, "John, good luck to you, boy. Carry it through all the way, old fellow. Those are villains. But, John, I'm afraid we can't keep that luncheon engagement in a public restaurant. I'd just as soon not be seen with you." This was a clear implication. They really didn't put it that badly. So, not being able to get any work in New York, and it becomes a terribly frustrating thing. And this is the thing about the blacklist that I'd never realized until one has been blacklisted. Until one has had this cloud descend over them where they're suspect and with no one to go to. Even, see, I was never told why I wasn't employed. Fellows that had been glad to have my services before would make excuses, and some of them that hadn't heard that I was in trouble, you see, would audition me and get terribly enthusiastic and get the show all ready to go on there, and then word would get to them and they'd start making excuses, call me and say, "Well, see me next Tuesday." And then the next Tuesday they'd say, "Well, see me next month. We've changed the plans for that." And one begins to doubt his own talents, you see, as this goes on week after week, and that stretches into months, and the months into a year, and then a year and a half. And so after a year and a half of unemployment and having to borrow money to keep body and soul together, and incidentally, Ed Murrah was a great man in this because he stood steadfastly behind me and saw that my family and I ate regularly, but it was a dreadful period. I went back to Texas to wait until the case came to trial. Nizer, in the meanwhile, Louis Nizer, was gathering information on the wrongdoing of Ware, the defendants in this case. And he ran into a very interesting thing, people that they had attacked before. For instance, the actress Kim Hunter, who was a very prominent actress here and won an Academy Award in America in 1949, had signed a petition in 1950 asking for clemency for a Negro in Mississippi who was sentenced to death, Willie McGee. Subsequent to that, Ware decided that everyone signing that petition was part of a communist plot, that really the communists were trying to embarrass Mississippi by asking clemency for Willie McGee, and so by implication and association, Miss Kim Hunter was a part of this communist plot, and they had gotten her blacklisted and completely destroyed her career and terrified her, and had offered to take her off the blacklist and restore her to employability if she would join with them in several projects that they had. And then she finally did. And we wanted her to testify. She loathed and despised Ware. Wanted her to testify, but she was too terrified. And this was true of a great number of potential witnesses, people who had been treated to this, weren't willing to get on the witness stand and go through, incur that ire of Ware again. Well, after 6 years, I went back down, as I say, I was down in Texas, homesteading, down there with my kinfolks. We're big visitors, we folks are. We go and visit kinfolks when we can't earn a living for ourselves. It's a very handy thing. You ought to try it sometime. So I stayed down there and I visited with my family until 1962. And Nizer called me and said the case is on the calendar of the court and the trial is going to start. And I came back to New York. And of course I thought I'd be met with huzzas and hoorays. And it turned out everybody in radio and television had forgotten who I was or what I ever did. Oh, some old friends, of course, didn't, but most of the producers and directors had, and I realized my career had been stopped in mid-flight and would probably never be taken up again. And I also discovered that no one really cared whether I was involved in a lawsuit. They'd forgotten the issues, almost. I'd run into old acquaintances, they'd say, oh, yes, you were in that suit. Is that thing over, John? Did you win it? And here my whole life, see, was dedicated to this trial that was imminent. At any rate, the trial started in April. And by this time, Mr. Nizer had persuaded David Susskind, a producer, who incidentally has had television shows in England too, and you might know him, Charles Collingwood, a colleague of mine at CBS, who is a very fine news analyst and a newsman and a good friend of mine and who knew all about the machinations of Ware and had been associated with me. He got Mark Goodson, a producer of What's My Line. I'd worked with Mark Goodson. He brought them all into court, and they each one got up and told about their experiences with Ware. For instance, Susskind told he produced dramatic shows on television. He got up and testified under Mr. Nizer's questioning that every week before he cast a dramatic show on television, he had to submit the names of each one of the actors, actresses that he was going to propose to use to Ware, and Ware would clear these. A member of Ware, rather, the secretary of Ware, Mr. Vincent Hartnett, would clear them for a fee of $25 apiece. And if he used the same ones the following week, he had to submit the names nevertheless again, in case the fellow had become subversive in the course of a week. But he only charged $5 for repeats, you see. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Susskind, so outraged at this, is he submitted Santa Claus's name one time, and the fellow cleared it for $5. This is in the testimony in the court. Mr. Nizer asked Susskind on stand, said, Mr. Susskind, did you ever use children in any of your dramatic shows? And he said, yes. He said, well, you certainly didn't have to submit a child's name to have it politically cleared for appearance on air by this group of Ware. And Susskind said, yes. As a matter of fact, we had one 8-year-old girl. We searched all over the country for an actress capable of playing the role, found a very intelligent and very delightful and talented little 8-year-old girl, and I submitted her name, and it came back unacceptable, politically unacceptable. And so Niza backs across the courtroom, and the jury, of course, gasp at this. And Niza says, what was she unacceptable about? And Susskind says, you'll have to ask the defendant, Mr. Hartnett. So when Niza got Hartnett on the stand, he was the defendant in the case, he said, Mr. Hartnett, did you clear children? He said, yes, there were two categories of children that we had to watch. One, particularly precocious children, you know, that get hold of the Communist Manifesto and digest it and then become real dangerous conspirators, and others whose parents had been associated somehow with something progressive or liberal, and consequently the child was suspect. Mr. Mark Goodson got on the stand in the course of the trial and related how he had had to fire a great number of the leading off of his What's My Line show, you know, the panel show, What's My Line, a great number of the leading names in American show business simply because they didn't meet the specifications of a wear. He had to fire an actress, incidentally. She was Anna Lee, who used to be a movie actress in England. She'd come over here and she was doing a panel show for Goodson, and her name was similar to that of an actress who had been blacklisted. So he was told to get her off the show because she might be confused with the others. And he refused to do it, but he had a great deal of trouble. Well, as I say, this was the kind of testimony then that we presented and the jury sat and listened to. What of the defendants? They got up too, and they presented their testimony. But the interesting thing is, Mr. Hartnett testified on the stand that the United States government standards of protecting itself, its laws against subversion, its laws against treason, weren't sufficient. And its court system wasn't sufficient. It didn't meet the standards of a ware. And consequently, a ware had to set up its own system of justice to mete out justice to wrongdoers. In other words, a ware was literally what we call in America a vigilante organization. And incidentally, a great many of them existed in all areas of American life. Groups of citizens who decided that the institutions of justice in this country and the laws that had been properly passed were not sufficient to protect us against this dread conspiracy. And consequently, they set themselves up, these vigilante groups, as aware was, set themselves up as the legislature to pass their own laws. They became the judge, the jury, the prosecuting attorney, and all too often, the executioner on the lives of those persons who fell under their ban, such as me. Well, the jury sat and listened to them. Interestingly enough, although Ware had huffed and puffed in the years past about what they were going to do once they came into court with me, they'd prove that I was actually the very essence of subversion, they didn't bring one witness in, nor did they introduce one shred of evidence to prove the truth of their allegations. One of their allegations, for instance, that they had made in their original bulletin against me was that I appeared at a dinner in 1946 in the Astor Hotel in New York with a known communist, and that this dinner was under communist auspices. And this is all. This is all they said. Then they cited this gentleman with whom they said I appeared as an entertainer. Another entertainer, they cited his subversive background, didn't cite any from me, but it made it sound as though I was involved with him in some deadly plot. What they didn't tell about that dinner, it's true that I did do such a dinner. It was the year one birthday for the United Nations under the sponsorship of Harold Ickes, at that time Secretary of the Interior of the United States, and Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt. The principal speaker at that dinner, which incidentally they didn't mention in this bulletin they put out on me, was Secretary of State Edward Stettinius. The honorees of the dinner was the Security Council of the United Nations, all of whom were arrayed in front of me as I got up and entertained. As I say, I was there, all right. They were right about that fact. They didn't mention also that this dinner was broadcast full network over CBS. Well, this is the kind of charges, I mean, the kind of nonsense that they'd pumped out and destroyed the careers of hundreds of persons besides myself with, you see, by this innuendo and rascality. The upshot of the thing was that the jury sat there for 3 months, heard their defenses and heard our charges, and Mr. Niza, who made me fairly weep as he described the hardship and heartbreak that I'd gone through, and as he said, see this young man, this fine young man, as he goes with the world's back turned on him and harassed until he has to go back down to Texas. No reflection on Texas, by the way, in case some of the jurors came from Texas, too. At any rate, He asked for $2 million, which rather startled me. I'm rather vain, but I've never been under the impression that I'd really been damaged $2 million worth. But Nizer asked that I be paid $2 million damages. The jury went out, and incidentally, by this time, this trial had taken on national importance. There were Hollywood and Broadway stars there every day watching it eagerly, and the newspapers were filled with it every day. They were all down there. The jury went out and stayed 30 minutes and came back in, and we thought they'd come in with a decision, but they said they wanted to ask the judge a question. So he sat them all down, and the foreman of the jury got up and said, "Your Honor, can we give more than $2 million?" Whereupon Mr. Nizer sat down in his chair real hard, because he'd never been accused of asking not enough damages for a client before. The upshot was the jury went out, came back, and within another 30 minutes with a decision of $3.5 million. And thus the case of Fault versus Aware was over. Well, when the $3.5 million judgment was announced, the word went out through all the American newspapers and many of the foreign newspapers, because it was a record-breaking judgment. It had an interesting result in several ways. It brought forth a host of friends that I never knew I had before, and many of whom just several months before didn't know that they were my friends either. I had offers to go on vacations on their yachts and enjoy their summer homes and that sort of thing. Those were the superficial things, and of course it had, as I mentioned at the outset, a very therapeutic effect on my bruised feelings. But essentially, the $3.5 million judgment, incidentally, which I never collected, because the defendants were insolvent. But the $3.5 million judgment was not the important thing about this case. That size judgment had little to do with any talent that I might have had, and the jury wasn't addressing itself so much to the wrong done me personally, and I never felt that it was. What the jury of 12 good men and women, true, were saying as American citizens, a jury of my peers, were saying is that this kind of thing must never happen in America again. And they were saying it as loudly as they could. And of course, a $3.5 million statement is a pretty loud one. A great number of similar organizations to Aware, which incidentally dissolved very shortly thereafter, got the message. I've been asked if this put an end to blacklisting. Yes, to a great extent, see, it became an economic hazard to the networks and the agencies to even listen, to submit to people of these kind. And I've more or less exonerated the agencies and the networks and the persons that did give in to the pressure of Aware and these similar vigilante groups, because they were as much victimized by the fear as the entire community of America was by this fear called McCarthyism. We've climbed a long way out of that, and I've been asked by a great number of people, do you suppose this could ever happen in Britain? Well, it's my own feeling, having been to England and having been an Anglophile all my life and having a profound respect for the British sense of fair play and their outrage at injustice, that such a thing is impossible. Not only that, I got so carried away with being an Anglophile that I married one, and now I have a nice wife that's British, a Margate girl. But at any rate, my point is that wherever hate or wherever fear comes to dominate a society and replace reason and common sense, that society, wherever it be on the face of this earth, stands in good way of giving injustice the kind of prominence that it enjoyed during the McCarthy period in America.
That was John Henry Falk. The next program in our series, America Since the Bomb, will be a new production of the play The Zoo Story by Edward Albee. It can be heard in the third program next week on Thursday, November the 24th at 7:50 p.m.